Hello, this is Alton Banks reading from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we begin this week's Triangle Business Journal with a look at the biz page. Under the heading of Pirate Remembered comes the article, Blackbeard Sails Again in North Carolina. Blackbeard's flag is flying again in North Carolina waters, at least for the summer. The black flag associated with Blackbeard will fly on three North Carolina ferry routes in observance of the 300th anniversary of the pirate's death in 1718. It'll be a neat reminder for our passengers that they're plying the same waters that Blackbeard sailed 300 years ago, Ferry Division Director Harold Thomas says. Of course, three centuries ago, North Carolinians weren't quite so excited about Blackbeard, whose real name was Edward Teach, as he terrorized shipping from his Queen Anne's Revenge. The Commonwealth of Virginia finally got fed up and sent Lieutenant Robert Maynard south to deal with the pirate. Blackbeard's run ended on November the 22nd, 1718, when Maynard's sailors killed him in a fight near Ocracoke. And under the heading of Changing Course comes the article again, Carrie's McGregor Downs Country Club for Sale. McGregor Downs Country Club opened in 1967, when Carrie was just a small town outside the reach of Raleigh. And it always had a swank air as a place where many of the area's elite, including NC State University coach Jim Valvano, resided. The course belongs to California private equity group Concert Golf Partners. Concert, which owns 16 clubs, wants to sell to Club Corp. In a letter to McGregor Downs members, Concert chairman Peter Nanula called Club Corp the only one company in our industry that can take McGregor Downs to the next level. Concert bought MDCC for about $10 million in 2014, retiring the debt, but requiring members to lose their equity. Nanula says McGregor currently has about 700 members, and Concert has invested some $4 million into the facility. And under the heading of Update, the article, Want a New York-style brownstone? There's just one left. If you still want a New York-style brownstone in downtown Raleigh, you've still got a chance. Harkett Place initially called for 19 row houses with rooftop terraces when it was announced in 2016. But developers Trish and John Healy found that buyers wanted more space, so some were combined into larger units. Now 16 of the 17 units have been sold. Still on the market is 409 East Target Street, priced at $1.045 million. And under the heading of Capital Issue, the article, Downtown Raleigh is Booming, and How Can Everyone Benefit? Growth wasn't the only issue people talked about at the Downtown Raleigh Alliance's State of Downtown event on April 17. The panelists and speakers at the Raleigh Convention Center repeatedly brought up inclusivity, but few people delved into the specifics of what could be done to ensure that the growth happening downtown benefits people of all races and incomes. One of the few was Katie Gales, Director of Entrepreneurship Initiatives at Wake Technical Community College. One of the most significant obstacles she sees is access to capital. If you have a good tech-oriented business, you will find someone within the triangle to make it grow, Gales said. But if you're opening up a dry cleaners or a daycare center or a lawn care business, you might be challenged. Access to capital is difficult for the Main Street businesses if you don't come with your own resources of some kind. And under the heading of New Effort comes the article, Changes Ahead at PNC Arena. When hockey and basketball season starts back up this fall, fans attending games at Raleigh's PNC Arena will notice some big changes. At the Capital Budgets Committee meeting April 16th, the Centennial Authority, landlord of the arena, approved several improvements to bolster the fan experience, an initiative pushed by the new Carolina Hurricanes owner Tom Dundon. Among the changes, buying a 3D projection system that would cost about $1.8 million. The system will allow arena operators to display enhanced graphics on the ice and basketball court before and during the games. Use of theatrical lighting that would cost about $1 million. And replacing 6,500 upper-level seats in the arena that's expected to cost about $900,000. Jeff Merritt, executive director of the Centennial Authority, says some improvements were tabled during the meeting, including installing a giant rectangular scoreboard that would have dwarfed the arena's current scoreboard. He says the authority needed more time to see what changes needed to be made to accommodate the scoreboard and still provide unobstructed views for concerts and other events. Now, finishing the biz page today comes under the heading of Launching Leaders, the article Teaching Innovation, One Student and Professor at a Time. Anna Sowell, a junior at UNC Chapel Hill from Asheville, was in South Africa last summer when she saw how vinyl that had been used on billboards was turned into sleeping bags for the homeless. Given that her father is in the billboard industry, she knew how much used vinyl a billboard could produce. So what could that mean in the United States, and how could you use that and commercialize it? That's where Innovate Carolina comes in. The program held by Judith Cohn, the Vice Chancellor for Innovation, Entrepreneurship, and Economic Development, is designed to foster entrepreneurship for both students and faculty. Academics, she notes, are not trained to be marketers and salespeople and to understand how to translate their ideas. We're there to help them do that. Cohn joined UNC in 2009 and moved to her current position in 2015. So April 12th, Innovate Carolina held its Innovation Showcase. The event had 48 presenters, 10 of them faculty, and a total of 383 people in attendance. Significantly, that group included 150 investors. The program teaches the budding entrepreneurs how to make an effective pitch. State the problem, state your solution, explain the current solutions and market conditions, and then detail who is on your team. Whether you're practicing a pitch in Chapel Hill or asking for millions in Silicon Valley, that's basically the process. Cohn says the pitches have improved as the program has matured. She also said the program has brought in experts from across the UNC campus to help students especially think about problems and solutions with specificity. Innovate Carolina provided Sowell with a commercial-grade sewing machine so she could begin to experiment with making products from the used vinyl. Ultimately, whether Sowell or any student or professor succeeds will depend on two key traits, a willingness to learn and tenacity. If they are not coachable and they don't have that interior toughness to keep going in the face of adversity, then it will be very challenging for them to make it to the finish line, she says. Now we turn to the On Tech and Finance page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of hiring comes the article, Credit Suisse Breaks Ground on Expansion. Credit Suisse site executive Jim Captain says, you can feel the energy now at its Research Triangle Park campus. There's definitely a buzz, says Dan Seabolt, managing director and deputy chief operating officer. In addition to bringing 1,200 jobs to RTP, the expansion announced in 2017 has also been credited with pressuring legislators to repeal House Bill 2. We were pretty upfront in terms of our initial announcement that HB 2 was a factor, Seabolt says. Without a rollback in the regulations that executives saw as discriminatory, they felt they'd have difficulty recruiting the talent they needed to justify the expansion. And they communicated the sentiment to state officials, including Governor Roy Cooper, who, Captain says, helped drive us in the right direction. Our plans went on hold for a period of time, and dangerously on hold, where we actually started looking at other locations, Captain explains, noting that Credit Suisse would not have chosen North Carolina if HB 2 had remained the law. Public records back that up. Emails and other documents released last year show that once executives started looking outside the triangle, they received a competing offer from New Jersey, worth about $100 million in incentives. Credit Suisse held the ribbon cutting on the expansion April 17th. The next step? Executing the plan, Seabolt says. We've got a lot of hiring to do. We're on track and on time. If all goes as planned, the building could be completed by the middle of 2019, unifying a Credit Suisse operation now scattered across three locations. And after that? We're going to come back and refurbish this whole building, Captain says, of the firm's main RTP base. We want everybody to be happy to work here. With the second building, Credit Suisse will have the capacity to house 4,000 people in RTP, providing room for growth. Right now, the company has about 2,700 employees in the Triangle, including contractors. About 1,900 are full-time workers. Including contractors, the goal is to get to 3,000 by the end of the year, Seabolt says. And on the heading of cashing in comes the article, Red Hat Leaders Make Insider Stock Sell-Offs. A review of securities filing shows Red Hat executives are already having a good year when it comes to inside stock sell-offs. Aaron Oberoi, Executive Vice President of Global Sales and Services, just sold $2.3 million in Red Hat shares. That's according to an April 10th filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, which shows that he sold 15,000 shares of common stock. He still owns 74,457 shares. Oberoi's sale is his biggest since May. It's also the biggest single stock sell-off made by a Red Hat executive in 2018. But he's not the only executive at the Raleigh-based open-source software firm to make a major stock sale in the past year, a review of SEC filings shows. The top 10 inside stock sales at Red Hat since April the 27th, CEO Jim Whitehurst made two of 2017, $4.2 million. The Vice President of Products and Technologies, Paul Cormier, June 9th, 2017, of $2.4 million. And again, Cormier on June 7th for $2.7 million. And Cormier on June 5th for $2.7 million. Oberoi, May 1st of 2017, $2.6 million. Whitehurst, April 2nd, 2017, $2.3 million. Cormier, May 5th, 2017, $2.3 million. William Kaiser, director at Red Hat and a partner at Greylock Partners on April 3, 2017, $2.2 million. Oberoi, April the 10th of 2018, $2.1 million. And Whitehurst, July 19th of 2017, $1.7 million. And under the heading of Big Deal comes the article, Raleigh Startup Plans Target Distribution Deal. A Raleigh startup is about to hit the shelves of more than 1,000 Target stores. With this deal, Murphy's Naturals, which manufactures plant-based mosquito-repelling products from Loading Dock, Raleigh, near downtown, has grown its business in a pretty monumental way, says founder Philip Freeman. 2 years ago, following Murphy's appearance at the National Hardware Show, a product representative who counts Target among his partners reached out to Freeman about the repellent. He thought Target would really like the product, and he asked if he could represent it, Freeman says. Last year, Target agreed to test one of Murphy's products in 300 of its stores. Then Target made its massive order last September. The commitment will help Murphy's double its revenue in 2018, Freeman predicts, and will represent about 20% of Murphy's overall business. After the quantity commitments, his team got to work, hiring seasonal help, and organizing its manufacturing lines. This is a seasonal product, he says. We had to do a lot of our planning on the front end. You're doing a lot of the purchases of products and components well before the launch. And finally, on the tech and finance page comes under the heading of Tower Industry, the article, More Cash Means More 5G Opportunities, CEO says. Taking advantage of 5G opportunities requires capital. And Durham's EcoSite has an even bigger coffer than previously reported. The $90 million the tower company recently secured could be just the beginning, as an additional $70 million has been committed, its CEO confirms. A securities filing disclosed this month for EcoSite 2 shows a $100.7 million founder and, according to EcoSite CEO Dale Carey, just $30 million of that total is part of the previously announced $90 million, leaving an additional $70 million available. Carey says it's unlikely the firm would increase its take until 2019 and that it hadn't been planning on making the full $100 million infusion public yet. Obviously, the wireless space is alive and vibrant and all churning toward a 5G and Internet of Things future, he says. Taking advantage of the opportunity requires a large wallet. Tony Peduto, CEO of CTI, a tower operator that recently moved its headquarters from Boston to Cary, says research is all pointing to data demands that are going to more than double in the next 3 years. Tower companies need available capital to make deals quickly in a fast-paced industry. Now we move to the On Life Sciences page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And our first article from the heading of In Durham is Co-working Hub Debuts New Durham Digs. A Durham Life Sciences co-working hub has officially opened the doors of its new location on the heels of an existing tenant's $30 million buyout. Earlier this month, Belgium-based biopharmaceutical giant UCB announced its acquisition of Duke University spinout Element Genomics, founded in 2015, for up to $30 million. Element was one of the first tenants at BioLabs North Carolina, says BioLab founder Eric Lindsley. We need 10 more of them, he says, noting the deal was significant in terms of validating the model. BioLabs North Carolina formed in 2015 and first operated out of Duke's Carmichael building before moving into a 42,000 square foot space in the Chesterfield building in downtown Durham in November. The official opening was April 18. BioLab's mission is to provide a time and capital-efficient home for early-stage life science companies with room for about 40 tenants. Lindsley, a former managing partner at Pappas Capital, says BioLab's North Carolina is currently at about 50% occupancy and hopes to be at 80% by the end of the year. The monthly list price for space is $2,300 per month, plus about $300 per full-time employee. If companies also need a private office, those run $1,000 a month. BioLab's sponsors include the likes of GlaxoSmithKline and Eli Lilly, says Ed Field, president of BioLabs North Carolina. BioLabs North Carolina is looking to secure more of these types of sponsorships, with the attraction for pharmaceutical companies being access to promising early-stage companies for investment or partnering opportunities, he says. BioLabs also has sites in Cambridge, Massachusetts, San Francisco, San Diego, and New York. And in other articles on the Life Science page, under the heading of Drug War, comes the article, One Way to Fight Opioids? Deactivate Them. The AmerisourceBergen Foundation is taking a scientific approach to fighting the opioid crisis in North Carolina and a number of other hard-hit states. Since the end of last year, it has distributed close to 55,000 drug deactivation resources across the country that are designed to deactivate prescription medications that are expired or unused. Unintended access to expired, unwanted, or unused medicines continues to be a leading cause of opioid misuse, Susan Lorenz Fisher, Director of Corporate Citizenship with AmerisourceBergen, said in an email. According to recent reports, nearly 40% of those who have misused prescription pain medications over the past 5 years obtained the drugs from a friend or a relative for free. The disposable resources contain ingredients which, when combined with water, permanently deactivate opioids, rendering them ineffective, she said. So far, we've donated the resources at no cost to 17 counties, municipalities, and organizations spanning 6 states, including North Carolina. And under the heading of Genomics Investment comes the article RTI Invests in St. Louis Firm. Staying active on the deal front, Research Triangle Park-based RTI International has invested in St. Louis genomics company Purion DX. Matthew Jenkins, Vice President and Head of Corporate Development RTI, says, "We like the philosophy that the company has in terms of having a shared knowledge base." He adds that Purion DX is leveraging data to bridge the gap between next-generation sequencing and actually providing clinical care. While terms were not disclosed, Jenkins says RTI has participated in a round with other existing investors, and it's a typical growth stage investment. Purion DX disclosed in an SEC filing earlier this year that it had raised upward of $3 million. Jenkins notes an active corporate development program and expects the pace to continue to pick up. And under the heading of tainted water comes the article, Plaintiffs, DuPont is being fast and loose with truth. Plaintiffs in the recently consolidated Gen X class action lawsuit against DuPont and former wholly owned subsidiary Chemours have filed a thunderous response to the defendant's motion to dismiss the federal case. Defendants are once again playing fast and loose with the law and the truth, applying the wrong standard of review, ignoring longstanding principles of tort law, and falsely claiming that essential allegations are missing from the consolidated amended class action complaint, plaintiff's counsel states. The consolidated class action complaint was filed in January by Cohen, Milstein, Sellers & Toll, and Sussman Godfrey. DuPont and Chemours have owned and operated Fayetteville Works on the Cape Fear River since the 1970s. The defendants began discharging Gen X into the river in 1980 as a byproduct of manufactured vinyls, and since 2009 as a replacement to other chemicals manufactured commercially. Among other damages, plaintiffs are seeking an injunctive order to remediate the harm caused by defendants' conduct. DuPont and Chemours had filed a motion to dismiss the lawsuit. Plaintiff's complaint attempts to assert six claims against defendants: negligence, gross negligence, negligence per se, public and private nuisance, trespass, and unjust enrichment, the defendant's motion states. The complaint, however, does not allege that defendants caused plaintiff's alleged personal injuries. The failure to allege causation requires dismissal of each of the plaintiff's claims. The plaintiffs fired back, saying the defendants had a common law duty to refrain from contaminating the public water supply. And under the heading of Medicaid reform comes the article, Physician-Led Health Plan Finds Partners. Amid North Carolina's move to managed care from a fee-for-service model for Medicaid, which is slated for implementation in 2019, a physician-led health plan has partnered with Community Care Physician Network, CCPN, an integrated physician network established by Community Care of North Carolina, has inked a new agreement with Meridian Health, a family-owned group of health plans based in Michigan and Illinois. Meridian plans to respond to the request for a proposal currently being developed by North Carolina's Department of Health and Human Services, bidding for a portion of the managed care work. The new agreement is aimed at using CCPN's primary care network and CCNC's community-based care management to enhance work with providers in terms of quality care for Medicaid recipients. Our model is to try to contract with multiple plans and be that single source of care management that really helps improve the care outcome for the Medicaid population, says Stan Taylor, Senior Vice President of Business Development with Community Care of North Carolina. Medicaid provides health care for those with low incomes. Now moving to the real estate page from this week's Triangle Business Journal, comes under the heading of Jumping Up, comes the article, As Triangle Housing Trends Deepen, Home Prices Rise. Home prices across the Triangle saw a substantial bump in the first quarter of 2018, rising to a median price of just under $260,000. The increase represents a nearly 11% jump over the same time period last year, when the median home price was just $235,000, according to data from the Triangle Multiple Listing Services. The growth took place in all of the region's four major counties. Orange County saw a 14% increase in median home price, while Durham County's was nearly 13%. Wake and Johnson were just over 10%. Overall, the year-over-year increase for the Triangle was greater than at any point since at least 2011, which is the last year Triangle MLS provides data. The continued growth in home prices comes at the same time when elected officials are grappling with affordable housing shortages and builders are struggling to keep up with the demand for new homes. The combination of high demand and low inventory has continued to push home prices higher. We've pretty much blown through all the pre-recession metrics, says Birch Appraisals' Stacy F. Anfinson, who compiles and analyzes data on the residential real estate market. The Great Recession still looms large in the minds of real estate analysts, Anvinson says. But even when being conservative, the Triangle's metrics show no signs of the heated housing market abating. The population keeps growing here, so you have more customers, he says. But housing construction isn't getting out in front of this new trend. Instead, the availability of new housing remains low, meaning the Triangle isn't seeing the problem of overbuilding that occurred in the lead-up to the last recession, Anvinson says. Another data set, this one from Anvinson, provides a closer look at exactly where the increases are happening. In particular, the revitalization of downtown Raleigh is manifesting itself in higher home prices. Neighborhoods within the 27601 zip code, spanning roughly from the new Union Station location to Tarborough Street and north to the edge of St. Augustine University's, saw a 12% increase per year for homes that sold in the first quarter of 2018, compared to the prior sales price for sales that date back to 2010. No zip code in the Triangle had home price increases as steep as the core of the City of Oaks, according to Anvinson's data. His analysis looks only at resales of detached homes, meaning it omits townhomes, and compares the price of homes that were sold from 2017 through the beginning of this year to the prior sales price of the same home dating back to 2010. And with this article, there are a couple of graphs. The one most telling, perhaps, for those people who are in the interest of selling a house, the graph shows data at the end of quarter one in every case, and the y-axis is the average days on market. So this bar graph shows that in 2011, the average days on market was about 125. And then from 2012 on down, it went from 133 in 2012, dropped to 78 in 2014. 2 years later, it was 65 days. And in 2018, it was only 39 days. Now, in other real estate news, under the heading of Downtown Raleigh, comes the article, Old Gym to be Converted to Office, Maybe Redeveloped. A developer has scooped up a one-acre property just a block east of William Peace University, but says he has no immediate plans to build on the parcel. Hobby Properties bought the property for $3.5 million, which includes a parking lot and a 12,100-square-foot building that was most recently home to a Rapid Fitness gym. Today, it sits empty. In the short term, the firm wants to revamp the building and turn it into office space, says Hobby Properties president John Holmes. The goal, he says, is to bring more people to the neighborhood and the Person Street Plaza across the street, also owned by Hobby Properties. For now, we want to find a use that will put more people in the area during the week, Holmes said. The timeline for redevelopment might be 10 years. That building on that site is probably an underutilized use of the dirt, he said. And under the heading of New Concept comes the article, Real Estate Startup Wants to Buy Your House. Selling a home in the Triangle is not exactly difficult these days, but that hasn't stopped a fast-growing real estate startup from trying to make inroads in the Triangle by offering to buy eligible homes in as little as 3 days, a service supposed to make selling homes easier. San Francisco-based Open Door was founded in 2013 and entered the Raleigh market last year with a formal launch in February. The company buys homes and tacks on a fee similar to what a real estate agent might charge. In the Triangle, the average fee is 6.5%, but it can be as high as 12%, the company says. After a few repairs, Open Door puts the home back on the market. For the consumer, the benefit's in the convenience. Customers can fill out a form online and receive an offer from Open Door within as little as 48 hours. Even in a seller's market, you'd be surprised by how many people would much rather just pay our service fee, says John Enberg, Open Door's Raleigh general manager. Enberg says the company is doing well in the Triangle thus far, buying more than 100 homes in the last 60 days from Wake Forest to Durham. Now we turn to a slightly unusual page in the Triangle Business Journal called On the Brewery Scene. And under the heading of Just Opened comes a Q&A article entitled Pittsburgh Friends Launch New Raleigh Brewery. Fun Guys Brewing Company, a new brewery in Raleigh, is the brainchild of three friends from Duquesne University who wanted to abandon the cold weather of Pennsylvania and head down to the City of Oaks. Nick Brango, Carly Pina, and Nick Florenzano opened the brewery on April 14th. We wanted to go somewhere warmer because I like wearing shorts, and you can't wear them all year long in Pittsburgh, jokes Brango, the head brewer of Fun Guys and a student of the American Brewers Guild. So here are a couple of questions and their answers. How did you come up with the name? Florenzano. I was just sitting there at work one day, toying around with ideas in my head during a lunch break. This was when sour ales and wild beers were coming into our lives. Not only does it have a connection with the beer, but with us. Without yeast, all you can make is some expensive water. When people come to your brewery, what are some beers we can expect to taste? Brango. We will have 9 taps, and one will be a Randall. We'll have a pale ale at about 5.5%. We'll be doing a Saison. We'll have a number of session beers. Down the road, our first major expansion will be to add a barrel room with climate control. An issue regarding new breweries can run across is raising money. How did this work out for you? Brango. We were coming out of college without a whole lot of savings, so we had to seek investors. And we got lucky because our families were willing to invest in us. But you need to figure out what you want to do. If you're doing barrel culture, you wouldn't need all the stainless steel tanks. Just get pricing for whatever it is you think, and then double the initial cost. You always leave out things you need and find out about it later. You're located on Paula Street in Raleigh, near Linwood Brewing Concern and Sub-Noor. How'd you find this current spot? Brango. There were a few places we looked at. Actually, Barrel Culture's current location in Durham. We called a week after them, as well as 15 other breweries. That was in January 2017. The location we have now, our landlord said that 10 people called after us. Our biggest issue was being delayed. What we thought would take up to 8 months ended up taking 13 months. So what issues did you face? Brango. Basically, it was getting the permits. Initially, we had the plans to put the initial tap room around the back, but we were going to run into a number of issues from sprinklers, capacity, this, that, and the other, and that would have cost way more than our budget. And under the heading of Art and Beer comes the article, New Collaboration Connects Art Exhibition and IPAs. The North Carolina Museum of Art and Durham's Full Steam Brewery have partnered to release 4 hazy New England-styled IPAs in honor of the NCMA's new exhibit, You Are Here, Light, Color, and Sound Experiences. Full Steam plans to release the limited edition beers every few weeks throughout the spring, with cans featuring exclusive images of art in the exhibition by Jim Campbell, Durham's Heather Gordon, OMAI, and SUNY Park. The museum's exhibit runs through July 22nd. The beers will be sold at the brewery, at Irish Restaurant, and at select museum events. As a longtime resident of the Triangle, I'm continually amazed at just how much the North Carolina Museum of Art values and emphasizes community in its programming. The You Are Here exhibition takes community, social, and sensory connections to a whole new level, says Sean Lily Wilson, Full Steam's chief executive. So we collaborated with the museum and 4 artists, incorporating our own sensory element, explosively aromatic hops, and a hazy India Pale Ale. New England-style India Pale Ales are a popular current beer style, marked by their hazy appearance and juicy flavor. The first beer in the series was released in the Full Steam Tavern on March 29, followed by Heather Gordon's Echo on April 5th. The other beers will roll out in April and May, with Austrian artist collective OMAI's Tag 2 Light Graffiti Projections and Park's Photokinetic Grid. Never thought I'd see my work on a beer can. I do so much love the idea of a special brew just for You Are Here, Gordon says. When artists and businesses collaborate, we have the opportunity to bring more art into life and more life into art. Now we turn to the Around the State page from this week's TBJ, and the article is Why Downtown High Point is on the Cusp of Revival. As the High Point Market spring event began, the city's most prominent booster pointed to evidence showing that predictions of the event's imminent demise were unfounded. High Point University President Nito Cubain says he knows of at least three or four new furniture showrooms under construction downtown, some at a cost of $30 to $40 million. Attendance at the spring market event was projected to be up from last year. Cubain also said he sees momentum growing downtown, which should continue to grow with the development of High Point 365, a home furnishings entrepreneurial center planned for startups, and a $100 million-plus economic catalyst project centered around a new baseball stadium. Everybody was saying the furniture market was dying, Cubain said recently. I see three or four showrooms going up. That's very encouraging. There's a cheerful air in High Point about the possibilities. That's encouraging and inspiring to me to see everybody come together to make good things happen. Cubain, the chairman of a drive for a children's museum of up to 60,000 square feet, with a playground and cinema, as well as a conference center, says he has secured the required $100 million in funding for the downtown project. He says the biggest hurdle remaining is to find a site for the convention center. Developer Roy Carroll has committed to build a hotel either connected or adjacent to the conference center. Blue Ridge Companies has committed to building an apartment complex in the area around the ballpark, which sit at the corner of North Elm Street and Gatewood Avenue. Now we come to this week's cover story, which is entitled Billions at Stake in Medicaid Shift. So this article is a compilation of an article by Jennifer Henderson at TriBiz Health and about a half dozen selected stakeholders who play major roles as Medicaid in North Carolina undergoes changes. North Carolina's Medicaid program is about to undergo its most drastic change in more than four decades. At stake is a whopping $14 billion program that provides health care coverage to about 2 million North Carolinians, that's one-fifth of the state's population. About $3.5 billion of North Carolina's $23 billion budget goes to funding Medicaid, with the rest of money coming from federal dollars. The goal of the change is to increase the quality of care and provide greater predictability when it comes to costs. But it's an intricate process filled with sprawling administrative layers and uncharted territory for the state. And it has massive implications from power players such as Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina to doctors across the state and the disadvantaged patients who depend upon them. In North Carolina's current arrangement, the state pays health care providers directly for each service provided to Medicaid beneficiaries, which is called a fee-for-service model. In the new model, the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services will delegate management of services to prepaid health plans, or PHPs, selected through a bidding process. That model, called managed care, is scheduled to take effect July 1st. Selected PHPs will receive preset monthly payments from DHHS and contract with physicians to provide services to their members. In theory, managed care would rein in costs while providing patients with the care they need. But in the high-stakes realm of health care, many involved in this shift share concerns over how the move will shake out and how the money will flow. So here is the first of several experts who are commenting on this Medicaid shift, and that's Dave Richard, Deputy Secretary for Medical Assistance at NCDHHS. At the center of the massive move is Richard, who joined the Department of Health and Human Services in 2013 after more than two decades leading the ARC of North Carolina, which serves people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Richard now heads up the state's Medicaid and NC Health Choice programs. And even Richard, an experienced leader, says preparing for the move to managed care has been, quote, a big lift, unquote. In 2015, North Carolina passed a law to change the delivery of Medicaid services. Currently awaiting federal and state approvals on the new managed care plan, DHHS expects to issue the request for proposals, sometimes called RFPs, for managed care entities in the next several months, he says. Once the proposals are selected, DHHS will negotiate a rate with the managed care companies for each contract year under those under which those companies will provide all services within that rate. Richard says DHHS will look at quality and operational standards as part of the RFP process. Have the companies met quality standards? Have they paid claims promptly? Have they responded to concerns? Aside from the aim of providing more cost predictability, Richard sees a lot of opportunities inside of managed care that are difficult to achieve in fee-for-service when it comes to the quality of care. For example, he says, it's easier to work on patient methods that really reward outcomes rather than just completing the service. Multiple managed care organizations are expected to strive for high standards and quality to secure the work going forward. Managed care will also have a strong focus on issues such as food, housing, and home life that have an impact on health. But the challenges are quite real. For example, how can the change happen seamlessly? And how do doctors and small practices manage the paperwork demands? One of the main challenges that our providers are telling us is the fear of multiple health plans creating more administrative burden for a physician's office, says Richard. The final measure of success? Will it help patients? Success starts at the beneficiary level, Richard says. The next expert is from Dr. Patrick Conway, president and CEO of Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina. Conway is from a small town in Texas, but he speaks in rapid bursts and a doctor himself. He shot up the ranks of the federal medical system. He was the deputy administrator for innovation and quality at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services before BCBSNC tapped him as its new president and CEO. His deep understanding of Medicaid was no coincidence as BCBSNC positions itself for a place at the table with billions of dollars at stake. And Conway has been outspoken on the need for new ways to manage care and its costs. He said he has seen the important role Medicaid plays in people's lives at both the personal and policy levels. Now, he says, as CEO of Blue Cross NC, we're hoping to help lead the state's upcoming Medicaid transformation. As Conway notes, millions will be affected. Through Healthy Blue, Blue Cross NC hopes to provide our state's most traditionally underserved Medicaid populations with high-quality, more affordable care, he says. We're excited about the future of Medicaid in our state, and if chosen, we will be ready to serve North Carolina's Medicaid populations on day one and for years to come. The next expert is Scott Markovich. He's VP for Medicaid Growth and Provider Development at Aetna. Aetna is also among dozens of potential payers, hoping to secure a portion of the state's managed care work through DHHS. The good news for a company like Aetna is that we know North Carolina very well, Markovich says. Aetna has more than 1,400 employees in North Carolina, and its total medical membership in the state is 412,575. Aetna is already educating provider officers, meeting with community-based organizations on which the Medicaid population is reliant, and educating providers on the benefits of managed care and how Aetna and others are working together to bring a high level of quality care to the members, says Markovich. He says the three most significant benefits of the move to managed care include care coordination. Aetna will be the care manager for the member to coordinate physical health, behavioral health, and pharmacy needs. You name it, he says. Second, a new focus on social determinants of health. And third, the ability to leverage provider networks with connections to Aetna. But the benefits don't come without challenges, Markovich says. Anytime you're moving a large population like this into managed care, there are a lot of questions. Once members are in the health plan, he says, they'll receive ample outreach to aid in navigating the new landscape. Markovich calls the RFP a very competitive process. Our next expert is Stan Taylor and Dr. Tom Roth. That's the VP of Business Development and COO of Community Care of North Carolina. Community Care of North Carolina began 2 decades ago and dubs itself the largest and longest-running medical home system in the United States. CCNC works with the likes of providers and pharmacists on a predictive data-bolstered coordinated care approach to improve quality of care and lower costs. Ahead of the reform, Taylor says, "We're really aggressively out there trying to work with commercial payers, and I think they're excited to work with us." This year, CCNC and the independent physician network it established have reached deals with WellCare Health Plans, Aetna, and Meridian Health. "We've had a lot of success with payers," says Taylor, "and we think it's going to be a good result for patients and the Medicaid program." CCNC is also upgrading its clinical systems through Virtual Health, a provider of population health as well as care management platforms. And a major area of focus for CCNC will be working with small, independent physician practices, says Roth. Those practices care for a bulk of Medicaid beneficiaries in the state, about 700,000 of the 2 million. The next expert heard from in the cover story is Brendan Riley, who's a policy analyst with Health Advocacy Project. But will this massive shift really work? There are those who have concerns, including the North Carolina Justice Center. Generally, when we've seen states transition their Medicaid programs from fee-for-service to managed care, getting multiple private plans to administer Medicaid benefits, it can bring its set of challenges for beneficiary, Riley says. If the incentives and the oversight mechanisms are not designed properly, he says, there may be plans improperly denying care. In other words, the managed care plans say no. There's lots of concern and anxiety bringing in managed care private plans, which may require patients to go through a lot of additional hoops and meet all kinds of requirements that might be hard to understand for the general public or healthcare providers, he said. Additionally, there will also be a new set of decisions for Medicaid beneficiaries to make, notes Riley. That includes evaluating a number of different plans and determining whether preferred doctors are in the network or not. But one area Riley says the Justice Center is excited to see attention to is social determinants of care, particularly if federal dollars are drawn for public-private partnerships in this area. For instance, if a child with asthma is living in a home with mold, or if someone's living in a home where there's interpersonal violence, such outside forces are intertwined with our health, says Riley. Riley also notes the move to managed care doesn't address the fact that many North Carolinians are ineligible for Medicaid because we haven't closed the coverage gap, he says. Increasingly, we're seeing lawmakers on both sides of the aisle pay more attention to the issue, he says, due to reasons including harm being caused to rural hospitals and the ongoing opioid crisis. It depends on whether the General Assembly may reconsider bringing in available federal dollars so that people in the coverage gap can lead productive lives with access to health care, Raleigh says. And the last set of experts covered in this cover story are Dr. Chuck Rich and Dr. Greg Adams. One's a family physician in Wilmington, the other's a pediatrician in Boone. Across the state, doctors are watching closely. As Wilmington's Rich puts it simply, change is coming. There's a sense of uncertainty and anxiety among independent providers over how daily practice and reimbursement will be impacted, as well as how additional layers will up administrative burdens, he says. In rural areas of the state, Medicaid is a big provider of insurance service for patients served by local physicians, says Rich, noting that's the case for about 30% of his own patients. Not accepting Medicaid is not an option for the rural provider unless they pack up and move, he said. Elsewhere across the state, Rich says, if you want providers to continue to accept the Medicaid patient, you certainly have to include adequate reimbursement to make it worthwhile. Boone's Adams notes that good care is local. He says that along with adequate reimbursement, physicians caring for Medicaid recipients also need to be equipped with case management and other support services needed to keep their doors open and be competitive. In the last 5 to 8 years, the number of physicians maintaining their own practice has really been plummeting, Adams says. And he notes that in terms of driving costs down, the discussion shouldn't be solely focused on doctors, rather addressing high pharmaceutical costs and bringing down the overutilization of emergency rooms. As this evolves, Adams will keep a close eye on which groups the state selects and whether those managed care organizations listen to the physicians. If the MCOs will listen to us and take our input, he says, I think we can really deliver some excellent care. Now turning to the executive voice page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, TBJ interviews Tim Humphrey. In front of a recent gathering of executives at IBM's brightly lit Executive Briefing Center, the firm's Research Triangle Park site lead said goodbye. Fran O'Sullivan, in her role since 2015, stepped onto a block to compete height-wise with her towering successor, Tim Humphrey. Holding up a metal high-heel stiletto, she hands it to Humphrey, the man tapped with filling her shoes. I don't know what size they are, but they're at least twice as big as mine, so he's going to have no problem filling them, she jokes. I will look forward to partnering with all of you, Humphrey tells the crowd. The group reflects the stakes of his hire. High-profile business leaders such as Jillian Monroe, Senior Vice President of Enterprise Cybersecurity at Fidelity Investments, Scott Levitan, CEO of the Research Triangle Foundation, and Mark Hoyt, Chief Information Officer of NC State University. IBM is thought to be the largest employer in Research Triangle Park, Humphrey says. And Humphrey says he's already aware of the pressure he'll face, particularly as his employer shifts from the hardware that's sustained it for decades toward emerging technologies such as artificial intelligence and cloud computing. The pivot is what makes leading this IBM location so enticing. A lot of people don't embrace change, he says. I embrace change. I think it's exciting. I love being uncomfortable in a situation or a new job. I think when you're uncomfortable, you grow the most. But in leading, not every decision is well received. O'Sullivan had to carry out difficult restructuring decisions during her tenure. Humphrey says that when it comes to tough decisions, communication is key. Sometimes you just have to make sure you over-communicate and show people the positive benefits of the tough decisions we have to make, he says. Humphrey applauds IBM's recent decision to reel in remote workers, saying that without IBM veterans at the office, he wouldn't be where he is today. And it goes back to college when he joined an IBM co-op program while at NC State. I was in the help center, he recalls. I was a guy you called up when your PC didn't work. When he graduated, he picked IBM over Cisco, and the rise up the ladder began. It accelerated 15 years ago when Humphrey joined an internal IBM leadership program dubbed NextGen with O'Sullivan as his sponsor. But his positioning began before his friendship with O'Sullivan. Humphrey says leaders just can't do their jobs. They have to get noticed. And he has advice for others hoping for their own ladder rises. You should always try to be spectacular by your own measurements in anything you do, whether your boss is looking or whether your boss is not looking, he says. Leaders must also have a good vision, he says. If you have a good vision for where you want to go, you can assess yourself, understand where you're strong and where you're weak, Humphrey advises. Accelerate those areas where you're strong. But what can really push a leader ahead is relationships, he says. You've really got to be one of those people who strives to make long-lasting relationships, not just up, but down and around, he says. If you make relationships all around you, I think it gives you more opportunity. A lot of people are just missing opportunity. Now turning to the viewpoint page of this week's Triangle Business Journal comes an invited article that pairs very nicely with the cover story, so I'm going to read that instead of the editor's notebook, which I frequently read. This article is written by Dr. Ed Weisbart, who's a family physician and chair of PNHPMO, former chief medical officer of St. Louis, Missouri-based Express Scripts. And it's called The Case for Improved Medicare for All. The unpredictable and unbearable cost of our healthcare system drives Americans into bankruptcy, keeps us from life-saving care, and distracts our business community from their core businesses. There's a well-proven solution hiding in plain sight, Medicare. This remarkably successful program rescues American seniors from poverty while dramatically improving their health. At every age group until we turn 65, Americans have the modern world's worst mortality rates. Once we reach Medicare eligibility, our mortality rates become among the best in the world. Medicare accomplishes this feat at a fraction of the operating overhead of the commercial Medicare commercial insurance industry. Parts A and B of Medicare report an overhead of less than 3%. By comparison, Aetna, Anthem, and United each report overheads greater than 15%. It's easy to understand the difference. Medicare wastes virtually nothing on sales, advertising, marketing, underwriting, multi-million dollar executive salaries, or profits. Medicare today is imperfect. It fails to cover some important healthcare services, for example, dentistry and optometry, and exposes seniors to significant financial barriers through deductibles and co-insurance. These flaws have created a niche for supplementary programs and Medicare Advantage. We should embed those corrections into the core offering and provide this improved form of Medicare to all Americans. Both chambers of Congress have popular bills that would accomplish this. Critics say our nation can't afford this, but they're wrong. There are at least 25 studies at both state and federal levels demonstrating that the savings of a Medicare for All strategy would match or outweigh any new costs. Economists estimate that anyone earning less than $500,000 per year would save more by eliminating health care premiums, co-pays, and deductibles than any small increase in the taxes needed to fund this. Three of the most important reasons we can afford this are the elimination of the redundant middleman insurance bureaucracy, purchasing power for pharmaceuticals and medical devices, and global budgeting for regional health care systems. Critics also say the free market will solve our crisis, but health care is unlike most other products. Our largest health care expenses happen when we are ill, desperate, and vulnerable. At these moments, we're the least able to shop around. That's a problem for a free market solution, dependent on individuals becoming more savvy consumers than large teams of actuaries and data analysts. For more than 52 years, Medicare has proven itself. Now's the time to improve it, provide it to us all, and stop requiring small businesses to become small healthcare experts. That's not why they're in business. Let's fix this for the business community, for our nation, and for every American. Well, that music means we've run out of time for this week's episode of Triangle Business Journal. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be certain to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.